A legal education means you will learn to speak in a new language. You will be taught to achieve insight into the world around you and to sharply question what you know.
You can't handle the truth!
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of the Only in Law School podcast brought to you by the Comedians at Law. I am your host, Matt Ritter, and with me this week is nobody, actually. It turns out we have a special episode because we ended up talking for about an hour with our amazing guest, Darren Cavanocchi, so I'm going to let you hear that full interview right now. But I do want to give a quick shout out to all of our law students who are struggling through finals, hopped up on Red Bull and caffeine and God knows what else. You're almost there, and for those of you who are 3Ls, congratulations, you've made it. Hopefully a couple of you have jobs. Probably most of you are going to be in the hell known as Docker View, or maybe you got a job, you know, a low-paying job somewhere at an immigration firm, and maybe the school hired you to be an assistant somewhere. Maybe Starbucks hired you. In any case, you made it through law school, and now you're entering the workforce, which is much, much, much worse. But congratulations in any case. Enjoy your summer. If you're studying for the bar, I'm the Comedians at Law are happy to entertain you. You know, we do a lot of shows during the summertime at school. So if you want your school to come, if you want us to come to your school, just have them email us at comediansatlaw@gmail.com and we'll come and perform at your law school and it'll be a great time. And without further ado, here is the interview.
So we are really excited. We have one of our biggest guests that we've ever had on this podcast. He's the creator and host of the hit TV show Deadly Sins on Investigation Discovery. He's an attorney. He's a legal analyst. You can pretty much see him on TV every single night these days on HLN or CNN or The Insider, Dr. Phil. Ladies and gentlemen, give it up for Darren Cavanocchi.
Well, standing ovation, my goodness. The applause is too much.
I want them to be I want them to be applauding on the other end of this.
That's great. Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
Well, you know, I was really excited to have you because I just want to jump right in. I want to get into your background, but I wanted to jump right into the fact that I thought you wrote one of the most on-point articles about the whole Donald Sterling fiasco the other day.
Yeah. I appreciate that feedback. It seemed to me that that there was a lot of emotionalism around Donald Sterling. By the way, as there legitimately should be. I mean, the guy, based on those remarks, is not just a grumpy old man, but clearly has some really disgusting, repugnant views. And the court of public opinion had already reached a verdict that he should be summarily executed. And it was just amazing to see it, almost like a lynch mob mentality of people that were against, not just against Donald Sterling. I think everybody was against Donald Sterling, but really swept up in this notion of not just ban him from basketball, not just make him write the multimillion-dollar check, but force him to sell the team. Yeah. And in the wake of that, and you know, I wrote a blog piece for HLNTV.com about this, and I'm assuming that's what you're referring to in terms of my views on it. I felt that it was taking it a step too far to force the disgorgement of the assets that he bought and paid for with his own money. And it's clear that Donald Sterling is an idiot. But I defend Donald Sterling not because I love idiocy, but because I love freedom. And ultimately, it struck me as, well, it reminded me so much of those freedom of expression cases that we all studied in law school, right? That
right.
Popular speech doesn't need protection. It's only disgusting, repugnant, unpopular speech that needs protection. And I can't stand Donald Sterling or his views, but just like it was so famously said, I'd fight to his death for fight to my death, not his death. Wow, that was a little Freudian slip. I'd fight to either of our deaths to protect his right to be an idiot in the privacy of his own home.
Well, what I really liked about the piece wasn't just the substance. but the fact that you were openly saying it, I mean, I think you were expressing an opinion that in some ways, because partly because of social media, in my opinion, and you can agree or disagree, people are a little bit afraid to go against the lynch mob.
Absolutely. And it's funny that you picked up on that, because I really had some reluctance to say it. But one thing that I've strived for in all of my quote unquote media work is to be authentic, and even so, or especially so, if that is going against the tide. And I've never been afraid to be an idiot on TV, to be an idiot in the courtroom, to be an idiot anywhere I go, or to champion an unpopular cause. And I would say to anybody who does this kind of work, whether it's in the courtroom, which after all is just a theatrical experience, as well, or whether it's in front of a TV camera, that authenticity trumps everything. And when I was willing to, well, I guess let me back up a step. When I first got into doing TV work, it was around some cases that initially it was me as a guest for some high profile cases I was involved in that were far beyond my experience level, but I took them anyway. And going on air, to discuss those cases. And I remember my very first TV appearance was with the Today Show. And they told me in advance what the questions were going to be, and I was up into the wee hours of the morning scripting out exactly what my carefully crafted answers were going to say. And then, of course, I got there under the hot lights of TV, and they asked completely different questions. And I mean, I had an out-of-body experience. I only know what I said on TV from watching the tape later. It was really, for me, it's kind of like the bar exam, where I just have no recollection of the whole crazy thing. And it looked terrible. I mean, it was really terrible because I was so focused on repeating the answers that I had scripted rather than just being in the moment. Mm-hmm. And it was only when I really got over the idea of having to look good or look polished all the time, and just be authentically in the moment, and I stopped writing down what I wanted to say, or even bullet points, and I just was there to have an opinion and be authentically and uniquely me, that's when the TV stuff really took off.
It's also because you're qualified, though. I mean, you know, not everybody can just wing it if they don't really sort of know what they're talking about, you know, in terms of opinions.
Well, yeah, that's kind of you to say. I'm qualified. And it's funny because I have my own negative self-talk around that, because my qualifications are less ivory tower and more street fighting thug. Mm-hmm. I mean, if we really want to get into it, I mean, I'm a guy who is I flunked out of college, or I guess I should say it politely. I was academically disqualified in the fifth year of my undergraduate studies. Talked my way into night law school with no bachelor's degree, and was able through, I think, just happy circumstances. I had this window where if you had more than 60 undergraduate units but less than a college degree, you did not have to sit for the baby bar. Wow. So I was able to avoid that. And even though I was terrible in law school, I mean, primarily because of my horrific, unbridled brushes with substance abuse, so I was loaded every day in law school, flunked out of law school, actually had to challenge one of my grades as the test being unfairly administered to get off of double secret probation and get back into law school. So when I went and sat for the bar exam, no one was betting, hey, that's the guy who's going to be a success.
I think you've just made a bunch of law students who, when they listen to this, they might just walk out of their law school exam.
They might be better off if they did. No, I'm kidding. Just joking about that. I think if anybody's going to take anything of value from it, it's that as human beings, that we really are capable of doing tremendous things. And you know, if you believe that you can play a big game, and you just suit up and show up, you can actually do some pretty incredible things.
Did you always think, you were sort of, I don't know if destined is the right word, but did you always feel like, hey, I was destined to do bigger things when you were, you know, in law school or before that, or how did you end up now where you are? I mean, you have so many things on your plate.
Yeah, well, it's pretty funny. I have in my office framed the cover page to my career report from when I was 12 years old.
You have a career report?
I have a career report, and it's just so perfect because I remember doing this career report as an assignment in school. Yeah. It's sixth grade, and this was my first brush with procrastination because this was a project that we were supposed to be working on all semester long, and of course I did it on the Sunday before it was due on Monday, and I remember the 12-hour day like it was yesterday that I sat there and did all the research and wrote out the report. And on the cover page of that report, it says, this is a story about what I, Darren Cavanocchi, will be like 10 years from now, or rather a speculation of what I will be like 10 years from now. I feel that while a person's physical characteristics may change, their basic psyche stays the same. If this philosophy holds true, I will probably be a bum, or even worse, a lawyer. Either way, you end up drinking something out of a brown paper bag. The only difference is where. Which is oddly prophetic, because this was before I ever had a drink or a puff of anything, and it was shortly after that I had a pivotal moment where everything changed and set me on the path that has us talking today, which is really quite bizarre when you think about it.
Yeah, no, that was some report card.
I knew that. It's funny because I knew at that point that that I wanted to be a lawyer, and I don't know if it was a cultural thing, you know, and the definition of a lawyer, I guess to tell an ethnic joke now, the definition of a lawyer is a bright Jewish kid that can't stand blood.
I have heard that one.
And so, you know, that it, and I say I'm Jewish, as you know, with an emphasis on the ish.
Uh-huh.
It's more of a, I suppose, a cultural thing rather than any you know, formal anything. But in my family, as part of the Jewish cultural thing, there were only certain limited career paths that were deemed acceptable, and it was basically doctor, lawyer, accountant, and if you were really the rebel in the family, you could be a stockbroker. But I was never particularly good at math, and I was always contrarian and liked to debate, and so it almost felt like destiny that the law was in my future. Although my behavior after that wasn't well aligned with somebody that really was going down that path. I mean, I was a solid C+ student in high school.
Well, George Bush was a C student, I believe, and he ended up being president. So.
And he did all right. But you know what's interesting? In the space of destiny, and I don't know whether you or anybody in the audience has this experience, but for me, I've always been strongly oriented around visualization, that for whatever reason I've had throughout my life these moments where I just have these images that I visualize very strongly, and then inevitably I'm able to produce those things. And I remember as a kid being home from school and watching Phil Donahue. And, you know, back in those days, Phil was the pioneer of the daytime talk show, and he'd run around in the audience with this goofy, long-stemmed microphone with that little Nerf ball thing on the end.
Yeah.
And he'd run into the audience, and I remember watching that, and just as some kids who were into Little League might look at a baseball player and think, yeah, someday I'll do that, and that's how I looked at Phil Donahue. And
so you did always kind of know where you were headed.
Yes, but I didn't always know how to get there, and that was, and I actively took steps, I think, to that looking at the time seemed like things that, you know, when you look at it on paper, you'd say, oh my God, that's definitely not going to get you there. I mean, not to be cryptic about it. When I was a young kid, I was really uncomfortable in my own skin. And I wasn't just big boned or husky. I was a fat kid. And I remember specifically my mom taking me to buy school clothes. We were not wealthy by any stretch. And I remember going shopping for school clothes at Sears and buying these tough skin jeans that they used to sell at Sears.
Yeah, Husky. I remember the Husky
jeans. And I remember buying my tough skin jeans in the size that they called a Husky. Exactly.
I don't think they use that term anymore, even.
I don't know, but can you imagine the marketing guys sitting around in the conference room going, you know, hey, Bill, what do we call these jeans? Like, loser fat kid jeans?
Yeah,
like, no, just call them Husky and they'll know.
They'll know.
You know?
They'll know. Every kid who's experienced that moment in the store where his mom was like, I think he's Husky, just that cringe moment.
For sure, and that was me, and I'll never forget. I mean, the pivotal moment when I was 13 years old and wearing my husky sized tough skins, and we lived on the outskirts of a very affluent area in Richmond, Virginia, at the time, and I'm going to school with these kids who were so seemingly well put together. You know, they were wearing the Levi's 501s in slim fit and the Izod shirts, the little alligator and the Sperry topsider boating shoes. And they just looked like they were hanging out with their parents at the country club.
It was like the kids who were at the country club at Caddyshack, and you were like the worker.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's exactly right. And I've just had that feeling of being on the outside looking in, you know, just feeling like I am just not like you people. And through a series of events, I was at a party that I had no business being at age 13. And the cool kids were passing around a joint. And for those listeners who don't know, a joint is a marijuana cigarette, contraband, in the legal world.
Know.
Yeah, they probably know. They may be lighting one up right now. But I remember one of the really cool kids passing that joint my way. And I took a hit off that joint, and in that moment, it was like a switch got flicked in my head. And in that moment, I no longer felt like I was on the outside looking in, and I no longer felt like I couldn't talk to the girls or I couldn't hang out with the guys. I wasn't on the outside. I was right in the center of the action. And I remember thinking in that moment, oh my God, I want to feel like this every moment of my life. And if you felt as uncomfortable in your own skin as I did prior to that moment, I'm sure you would feel the exact same way. And I pursued that with a vengeance. And so from the time that I was 13 years old until the time that I was 35 years old, 34 years old, you know, if it was a day ending in Y and I was awake, I was loaded.
So and I so think that all the days end in Y then, huh?
That's right.
I was just doing a little math there.
It's like one of those logic games. Yeah, and you know, and that brought me to some really, really, really dark places. Mm. And then I mean, I lost everything, absolutely everything.
So can we just talk about that interim? Were you working at a firm? What was your career while you were in this you know, sort of dark period?
Yeah, well, and it wasn't always dark. I mean, there were some really fantastically fun, silly moments in there too, which is what kept them going for as long as they did. But it did certainly get very dark. And through that time, I managed to make it out of high school, slide into college. We were living in Oregon at the time, so I started up at University of Oregon, go Ducks, and then. And then after my first year there, I had one of these epiphany moments where I realized I'd be having so much more fun if it wasn't raining all the time.
Yeah.
And so
you gotta get out of that Pacific Northwest.
Exactly. And I transferred down to San Diego State, looking at no other schools, but San Diego State did really well on Playboy's ranking of top party schools.
They always do. And I think they're always at the top.
They're a contender. And that was my only criteria at that time. And so in my fifth year of my undergraduate studies, the school decided that they could live better without me than with me and invited me to leave. And so that's when I barely, you know, I moved up to LA, barely made it through law school, started working at a law firm during the day. It was, I mean, just crazy, seemingly random events. I was working at a law firm during the day and going to law school at night, barely made it through. I was always interested in criminal law when I was in law school, partly because, you know, when you have murder cases or big dope cases versus studying about wills and trusts, at least given my orientation, I really liked the criminal. I just was fascinated by the criminal law. My criminal law professor was really cute. That helped matters considerably. And then when I got out, and I was working for this law firm that did really, really boring stuff. It was all workers' comp defense, representing insurance carriers and adjusters, fighting people who were trying to, whatever, get a few bucks for some back injury. And it was the same thing over and over again. And just, to me, it was so boring, it made my eyeballs bleed. And I remember going down to the Workers' Comp Appeals Board in downtown LA, and I'd finish my business there, and then I would walk the two blocks over to the criminal courthouse. Uh-huh. And literally wander the halls, just going in and out of courts, peeking in on trials and watching lawyers arguing in front of jurors and just dreaming and knowing that that's where I needed to be, and just knowing, God, somehow I got to make it to that, but I didn't know how I was going to do it. And then I caught a break that my dope dealer's half brother, who was a deputy sheriff, thankfully the statute of limitations is run, so I can
good.
Share freely.
I
about
yeah, things. I was flipping through the statute right now. Just
yeah,
sure
yeah,
I wasn't
yeah. Now we're
in any hot water here.
I think we're good, and I'm past caring anyway. I really, okay, I just really want to help people.
This isn't one of those gotcha podcasts.
No, although that happened to me too, but that's a whole other story. Yeah, thank you, Fox. Fox News. That's another story. So there I am. My dope dealer's half brother, he gets arrested for 6 counts of rape, and some of it was on duty, some of it was off duty. And so the sheriff's union was screwing around with him about whether they were going to fund his defense. And there was this notion that he was going to be that he was going to get stuck with the public defender, which he didn't like. And by the way, I've got a quick little tangent here. I know some really, really great public defenders, so no knock on the public defender system. There's some really, really dedicated PDs, gifted PDs. I think the problem is they've got a huge public perception issue, and I think the system is broken.
Right. I mean, isn't it just a workload issue? I mean,
well, it's a tremendous workload issue, but I also think that the system is anti-entrepreneurial, because once you're in, basically you can only get fired for, stealing from your boss or getting caught having sex on the desk with a client after hours and, walking out stealing Post-it notes or whatever it is. It's very hard to get fired from that job. And so as a result, I think, well, look, in that system, you get paid the same amount of money whether you're busting your ass for people or whether you're doing crossword puzzles in court with the DA and the bailiff. And so I think there's way too much crossword puzzles going on as opposed to ass busting going on. And that's because the system not only allows for it, but actually incentivizes it. But again, that's another story for another day. Matt, let's get back and talk about me.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's not talk about the
broken public defender system.
It's all about my favorite subject, which is all about me. But actually, I think there's a good lesson in here for the law students and the lawyers.
Smoke weed, isn't that the lesson?
No.
That was the whole lesson.
No.
The moral of the story is you got this break because of your dope dealer.
The moral of the story is do drugs, kids. Yeah. No, that's not the moral. So here's what happened. So the sheriff's union was screwing around with this guy, and they were going to give him the public defender. And I went to and the family comes to me because I knew enough criminal law to be dangerous. And to this family, even though I was a brand new baby lawyer that was doing workers' comp, to them, I'm a lawyer, so I can help. And so so I went to the sheriff's union and I convinced them to give me $10,000 to defend the guy. And then I went to the only criminal lawyer that I knew, who was a pretty high-profile guy, and I said, hey, look, I got this case. I got no idea what to do, but I got this check.
Wow.
And I said, I'll give you all the money. Just teach me how to do this.
That's wild.
And he said, kid, I like your style. Make the check out, too. And I ended up taking space in his office building, and he would throw me conflict work and give me a little appearance work to do. And he and I worked together on this deputy sheriff case, and we won it.
Wow.
And I ended up opening up my office behind that whole experience. And so I think the lesson there is that fortune sometimes favors the bold. And I knew in my heart of hearts that working, doing the workers' comp defense was not, it was just not me. And it's so funny, you know, sometimes we just have these little experiences. I'll never forget pulling out of the parking structure of my building and the lady that takes the parking tickets there even saying to me, like, hey, what is it you do? And I say, oh, I'm a lawyer for, you know, this firm, and we do blah, blah, blah. And I'll never forget, she just kind of looks at me and she shakes her head a little bit and she's like, you're bigger than that.
Wow.
And it was like, yeah, but it was one of those things. It was just one of those little things that gave me that helped nurture the seed that, yeah, I'm bigger than that. And even though I might get scared by taking on something new and bold, that push through and do it anyway.
So the lesson is both smoke a little weed and also be bold.
And do whatever those parking attendant ladies tell you. Clearly, they've got a direct line to the Almighty.
Well, they are definitely very powerful. So I think maybe we should be listening to them. So is that the firm that you now currently have, or were there multiple iterations and?
Well, what happened is I then lost it. So that's how I started working in criminal defense in the first place. And I really was quite successful at the beginning because I was willing to hustle and market and bring in cases, like I said, that were far beyond my experience level. And then what happened is I went off the rails. And this was right after O.J. Simpson, when being a criminal defense lawyer in the legal industry was kind of like being a rock star. You know, it was the pinnacle of what people could do, or at least in my world. And so I was hanging out in a music studio doing drugs all day and calling that network marketing. And I was, I was just doing crazy stuff and hanging out with bad people who were my people. And I really got caught up in that lifestyle. And I ended up, got a little crazy. I got married in this time. And my wife says to me one day, you know, hey, it's either this lifestyle you're living or it's me, and you got to choose. And when you're faced with a dilemma like that, there was only one reasonable thing to do, and that was get an ounce of cocaine and go to Las Vegas. and so I did that. And between 1995 and 2000, I was in and out of five different treatment centers, and that was where I lost everything. And when I say lost everything, I mean the wife threw me out, filed bankruptcy in 1998, everything. My practice was just disintegrated. It was nothing. And then when I finally, I had another pivotal moment, kind of like the moment, the mirror reverso image of the moment I had when I was 13, when I talked my way back into my wife's house, separate bedrooms, things were very, very cold between us.
Yeah.
But if I wasn't back there, I had just done a stint of like homelessness. So she took me in off the streets, basically. And I'm sitting there at what used to be my desk, now is her desk, and I was reading a book that I had bought three treatment centers ago called The Thinking Person's Guide to Sobriety. Mm. Because after all, no ordinary guide would do for me. You know, I'm a lawyer. I need
right.
the thinking person's guide.
The intellectual take on this.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and the thing that's so ridiculous about it in terms of that book's title, of course, for anybody that does any work in addiction, is it's your thinking that's so screwed up in the first place that leads you to take those kinds of actions. But, you know, whatever, no ordinary guide for me. And so I'm sitting there and I'm reading The Thinking Person's Guide to Sobriety. And I got a joint burning in the ashtray and four fingers of Crown Royal on the rocks in a glass. And I'm sipping my Crown Royal and I'm smoking my joint and I'm reading that book. And my wife walks by and looks at me and says the loving, kind words, "Aren't you supposed to be effing sober when you read that book?"
I would have thought, but I don't know.
Yeah. And you know, it seems so ridiculous to say it now. It's like waking up from a dream, but that was my moment. Mm-hmm. That was my pivotal moment when I saw with total clarity the gap between who I knew I was capable of being and who I was actually being. And I saw that gulf between those two things. And in that moment, it became intolerable to me. And I knew if I did not change in that moment that my life was going to be like some pathetic Groundhog's Day over and over and over again, where it was the same routine. Every night in a disgusting, drunken, loaded fit, I would throw away my paraphernalia and my drugs. And I'd say, "Oh my God, tomorrow's going to be different." And every morning I would wake up and it was not different. And by noon I had repurchased everything and, you know, off again. And what was so amazing about that moment, looking back on it, is I hadn't wrecked a car that night, but I had wrecked cars.
Yeah.
I didn't get arrested that night, but I had been arrested in several countries. I didn't wake up in the hospital in the throes of an overdose as they were inserting a catheter and giving me a pair of paper slippers because they didn't trust me with my shoelaces, but I had done that too. I'd done all of those things before, and none of those things got my attention. But in that moment, when my wife spoke those magic words to me, that got my attention, and that was on May 9th of 2000, and that was, you know, 14 years ago, and that was the moment when everything changed, and so that's when I started to piece my law firm back together from nothing. But at the time that I started to do that, my circuitry was so fried that I was moving furniture in a furniture store in West Hollywood just to put food on the table,
because
that was basically
mover.
The only. Basically, I mean, to my credit, it was very expensive furniture.
Okay, well, it was the nice, like the nice Persian furniture, like the really nice marble statues.
It was Chinese. No, these were like $12,000 armoires.
Okay,
they
well,
don't trust
not,
just
yeah.
anybody.
Yeah, that's the thinking man. That's the thinking man's furniture store.
It was. It for sure was. It was certainly a wealthy man's furniture store.
Yeah.
But then I began to piece together my practice literally one tiny step at a time. And that is what has now grown into what it is today, where I have offices in my home base is in LA, but I've got offices in Newport Beach and San Diego and Riverside and San Francisco and Sacramento.
Did the television sort of help blow up the law firm, or was it the law firm success that created the platform for the TV, or do they work hand in hand?
You know, it's so interesting. I've had very few experiences where somebody has seen me on TV and says, "Oh, I want to hire that guy."
Mm-hmm.
But there's no question that from the time I started doing TV, that TV was an important credibility builder, in the sense that there's just a general perception that if you show up on the magic box in somebody's living room, you must know what you're talking about. And so I used that in my marketing materials. I would take screenshots of me on Larry King or me on the Today Show or me on whatever show, and I would take a static image and I'd put that on my website, or I'd use that in some kind of an advertisement. And I think that did help. But I would say beyond the credibility building and to some extent the exposure that TV provides, it's not the thing that really drives that really drives the law firm business, especially in the world of criminal defense. Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem to be the thing that moves the needle. Although, if it weren't for doing criminal work, I wouldn't have developed the career that I have, not just in terms of being an on-air legal analyst, but the Deadly Sin show. And, it all started, I guess I have to credit Mel Gibson, where I had been. Mel Gibson. Oh, completely.
There's not a lot of Jews giving credit to Mel Gibson these days.
I have nothing but mad props for Mel Gibson. That's what the kids are saying nowadays, right? Mad props.
I think that was actually like 10 years ago. But
okay, sorry. So Mel Gibson got arrested for drunk driving and being anti-Semitic. However long ago that was, that's got to be 10 years ago.
Yeah, we remember that.
Yeah. You bet. And that mugshot, the whole thing. He looked almost as crazy as Nick Nolte. And so Entertainment Tonight was looking for somebody to go on air and do a little bit of expert blah blah about drunk driving cases and what's Mel Gibson facing and that sort of thing. And there was a lawyer who I knew who used to go on Entertainment Tonight all the time, and they called him and said, "Hey, could you come on and do this?" And he said, "Hey, I really don't know anything about DUI cases, but call Darren." And so they invite, so just serendipity, and they invited me to come down there, and somehow intuitively I knew that the story was going to live more than a day, because, you know, it was Mel Gibson. This was an enormous story. And so I went down there, and I brought 3 or 4 suit jackets and a couple pairs of glasses and some different ties, just some different fashion looks. And I figured, I come walking in with my wardrobe, and they say, "What the hell is this?" I said, "Well, I figured we'd shoot some different sound bites wearing different outfits. That way you could bleed those out through the week and you don't have to have me coming back and forth to do commentary." And that blew their minds. They said, "Oh my God, no one's ever thought about what our needs were like that."
Yeah, that is pretty brilliant, actually.
Well, it just goes to show you that a drunk, blind, half-retarded squirrel can find an acorn from time to time. It didn't strike me at the time as a brilliant idea. It just seemed like, it seemed kind of like natural, like, oh, this is what I should do. I don't know, just divine intervention. So they ended up liking me on camera, and they started using me as a field correspondent, and they were flying me all around the country to comment on some of the biggest, most important journalistic stories of our generation, like Balloon Boy, right? Remember Balloon Boy? I was doing stand-ups in front of Balloon Boy's house in Colorado, and they sent me to cover the divorce of John and Kate Gosselin. Remember John and Kate Plus 8? Very important.
Yes.
Tiger Woods and his infidelities and all that. So it all started because of Mel Gibson and my wardrobe fetish. And then the funny thing was, I was bobbing on the nose of a boat behind the home of Tiger Woods out in Florida, covering him. And it struck me that, it's always the 7 deadly sins of lust, greed, gluttony, envy, pride, and anger and sloth, but really lust and greed and gluttony that get all these people in trouble, whether it's Balloon Boy or John Gosselin or Tiger Woods or any of these guys. John Edwards, that was another case I was covering. And so that's where I got the idea for Deadly Sins, which in another sense has to be divine intervention, because the 7 deadly sins are deeply rooted in Catholicism. And as we've established, I'm Jewish. So I don't know where that came from, but that's how Deadly Sins, the TV show, was created. And anyway, I guess the lesson, kids, is smoke dope, good things happen, and follow a circuitous route in life like a pinball bouncing around.
Also, bring a couple of nice suits with you everywhere you go, which seems like something you do. It seems like something you do.
be prepared to change your look.
Seems like you got a nice selection of pocket squares.
Thank you very much. Yes.
you see, I'm imagining that you have a very nice, like, walk-in closet with, like, just rows and rows of suits and ties and pocket squares.
I get, my wife gives me a hard time about that, because yes, I do take up the lion's share of what is a very nice size closet. Oh, by the way, the epilogue to the story, I didn't even tell you the best part. The wife that, that had thrown me out and had rescued me from homelessness, she and I stayed together. We've been married 18 years. And of all the things that we've been talking about, and even the stuff we haven't, for me, I've been a study of transformation. And the fat kid and the husky sized tough skins, I've done now like 7 Ironman triathlons and a lot of extreme fitness kinds of things. And I no longer buy my suits in a size called husky. I obviously have shared a lot of the professional stuff, both in the accomplishments in the field of law and in the field of television. And that's not the stuff that I'm proudest of, though. The thing that that I am most proud of in my life is I've got a 12-year-old daughter who's never seen daddy under the influence of anything.
That's great.
And that's the coolest part of the whole deal.
Does she know about all that stuff, or she's too young to hear those tales?
Yeah, you know, she knows age appropriate stuff. I mean, she knows that daddy doesn't drink or run off to Vegas with an ounce of blow.
Hopefully she doesn't ever hear that one. I mean, maybe that one you could just leave out for many years.
I think that's wise. I'm not going to send her the link to this podcast, although I will share it with everybody else.
Nice.
I know.
You know what? I do want to jump into a couple stories real quick.
Yeah.
Cause we had talked about Sterling. I did want to get back to this.
Oh, I thought you meant stories about that one time when I whittling glory holes on the truck stop men's rooms. What are we talking about?
I hope that's just something you have a hazy false recollection
of. It's a joke.
There are a lot of rest stops between here and Vegas. I know that. I did see call Darren Kay on one of the old scribbled out. But no, I did want to get back to the Sterling, because I think it's, I just am wondering if you think, you know, this sort of Adam Silver's point was, you know, to your point about, hey, do we want to force a sale based on, you know, private thoughts? Adam Silver went on TV and said, you know, initially it was his private thoughts, but it's now public. So, you know, it doesn't matter that it was private. I mean, do you sort of agree or disagree with that? Because in the context of the fact that he now has, you know, it's not just an individual property, it's part of sort of a collective, for lack of a better word, the NBA, you know?
Yeah, I disagree with it. And I got to say, I have mixed feelings about it in the sense that there's part of me that wants to join the lynch mob. Because I think Sterling's got some disgusting, repugnant thoughts that he's articulated. But I don't agree with the NBA commissioner in this sense, that it wasn't, those thoughts weren't articulated from behind a podium bearing the insignia of the Clippers. These really were private thoughts that he never intended be disseminated. Mm-hmm. And it's a little hazy at this point. I mean, there's constantly layers to the story that are being revealed, but this appears to be a private conversation that he never authorized the release of this. It seems as if Ms. V, she of the face mask, Ms. Stiviano, is the one who released
Ms. Stiviano,
it.
Stiviano Lopez. I forget what her prior name.
She's got lots of them.
Yeah.
I see. There's been some discovery of her jacket, of her arrest records, using a bunch of different names. But and she, by the way, denies it. She denies that she leaked the information. But if you just think about it, take a step back and go, huh, wait a second. To give it a little context, you had just been sued for nearly $2 million for allegedly embezzling from the Sterling family. So who's got the incentive to release it? You do. Who had access to the stuff? You did. Who else in the world would be combing through hours of interview tapes of Donald Sterling to find this stuff, to stumble on it? Like, it just doesn't pass the grin test to me.
Right.
It just, like, it only makes sense that she was behind it. But, of course, she denies it. So I think those facts actually do make a difference. And the other thing that to me makes a difference is the way in which the NBA is trying to use Article 13 of its bylaws.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. I wanted to get into the bylaws. First of all,
yeah.
I haven't seen a copy of them, and they've kept them sort of very hidden. I don't know if you actually
yes.
saw the bylaws. I haven't seen them publicly made available.
No, I don't think they have been made available. Just portions of them. There's certain snippets that have been, that are allegedly the bylaws.
You know, you just led right into what I wanted to get into. The bylaws and the morals clauses, etc.
Yeah. Well, what I understand is that the particular section that the league is using to fortify their position was designed to address the situation where a team is in financial trouble. And that's how owners can force a sale of a team that is in financial trouble. And it wasn't to be used to thought police anybody. And when you look at the Clippers as an organization, they're not in financial trouble by any stretch.
Well, the argument they're making is, you know, the sponsors, you know, backed out, et cetera, you know.
Yeah, but first of all, and okay, if the sponsors back out, that doesn't necessarily mean that the team is in financial trouble. That means that there's a revenue loss for whatever that sponsorship is worth, which is offset, I think, dramatically by the amount of attention that has been drawn to the Clippers. You know, I live in L.A.
Yeah, I mean, their value is at an all-time high if you think about it.
Exactly. I mean, I've been a Lakers fan for years, although that's been that's a tough gig lately, just given their performance. But now I think there's a whole world of people whose attention is focused on the Clippers, not because they're a fan of Donald Sterling, but because of what the Clippers now stand for. I think the moment about Donald Sterling is bigger than basketball. It's the Jackie Robinson moment, which is bigger than baseball. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a Martin Luther King, I have a dream. Mm-hmm. This is a movement and is a reflection of where our society is, kind of a statement. It's much bigger than basketball, and I think the Clippers are the beneficiary of all of that.
By the same token, I wanted to ask, in the sense of, like, when you say it's bigger than that, you know, is it bigger than following the bylaws strictly then? You know what I mean? Is it... Does the movement have to be acted upon in a way that's bigger than, you know...
No. No, and here's why. Here's why you don't say this is a bigger moment, and so let's disregard the bylaws, because I don't think it's that they are regarding the bylaws. I think they are using the largeness of the moment to manipulate what those bylaws are and use them in a way for which they were never intended.
Mm-hmm. Don't you think that happens sometimes, you know, with the Supreme Court, with courts, you know, just in terms of how... Cultural shifts somehow.
I do. But this isn't. Hey, let's amend the bylaws because we've now had this moment, and now we need to be thinking about something. Let's have a reasoned discussion about what we want our bylaws to be. This is kind of like, here's an interpretation of the bylaws that we can use to get this result oriented.
Yeah, you think we're kind of going? I kind of agree with you that we are going ass backwards from the result that we want. How do we get him gone? How do we...
See, exactly. And you see, at the end of the day, it's just like those freedom of expression cases in law school, and we've talked about that before, that it is the ugliness of what he said is sanitized by the beauty of the Constitution. That is, it becomes less about, it's not about Donald Sterling anymore. It's about us. And in a larger sense, it's, hey, how are we going to deal with this? How are we going to be in the face of these ugly remarks? And in one sense, the outpouring of public support the largeness of the public outcry against racism, think about how much progress that shows. Think about how different that would have been only a few decades ago. That's an awesome, beautiful thing to behold.
But
when you use that to manipulate justice, that's where it turns to shit.
Right. I agree. The only contrary, you know, the contrary opinion, which I have a hard time I'm wrestling with, is I try to look at it through a minority lens, you know, sort of the feeling of, like, if we don't get results, then this is just another slap in the face.
Yeah, I get that perception. And, you know,
Especially in the context of the fact that it's an all-white-owned league, and all the players and, you know, they're technically employees are, you know, 70-80% minorities.
Right. But let's also look at something else. there's this comes out of what Donald Sterling said. This didn't arise because a bunch of Clippers got together and said, you know what, Donald Sterling's racist policies within the Clipper organization are now intolerable, and let's rise up against that. As a matter of fact, the Clippers as an organization, according to the reports, I mean, obviously I'm not inside the organization, but I've read and studied quite a bit about this, but according to reports, are run in a way that's not racist. They've had more success in the last couple of years than they've ever had in their history. They seem to be a highly functioning team.
Yeah.
And by the way, the players also are, I don't know if complicit is the right word, but look, they got their benefit of the bargain too. That is, I wonder if the Clippers really, really care in a sense about who about the personal views of the owner. That is, I can't imagine on draft day when it comes time for the Clippers to select and they're gonna hold up the jersey with some young man's name on it and say the Clippers are gonna take insert your name here. I can't imagine a set of circumstances where that young person is gonna say, nah, I'll pass. Because
yeah, well,
by the way,
I think that brings up another interesting point about ownership, and I actually wrote a joke on Facebook about, hey, if we're gonna delve into it, I mean, some of these other owners have things in their personal and business dealings. You know, I mean, take Dan Gilbert. I don't know whether or not Quicken Loans is responsible for part of the subprime meltdown, or I don't know what Prokhorov did to acquire his billions in Russia.
Right, and I agree. You know, Mark Cuban came out and urged caution when the story
first
broke.
Yeah, then he backed off, though. He did. That's why I thought your article was even more interesting to me, because even Cuban, who's pretty radical and free thinking, it seemed like he was overwhelmed by the Twitter sphere.
I think his initial comments were really well taken. That today it's racism, and tomorrow what thoughts and beliefs and personal views are going to put you on that slippery slope? Is it going to be homophobia? Is it going to be something else? Who knows what it is? And I just think it's a dangerous place to go. And by the way, owners, as you're talking about, it's a be careful what you wish for kind of a thing, because once you start digging in, once you now establish that precedent that, hey, your personal privately expressed beliefs could be the basis to violate this Article 13 clause, which we now interpret to be this way, you better be careful, owners, because it may turn around and be used as a sword against you.
Yeah.
And I guess I just fundamentally... I just, as repulsive as Donald Sterling is on so many levels, it's just not about Donald Sterling. It's about how do we want to be in the face of that which offends us.
Yeah,
I just think it's important to put on the blinders, just like Lady Justice.
Yeah, no, I think it's interesting just to back up your point about, do the players really care? I thought, I don't know if you saw Bomani Jones, he's a sports reporter. He had a great take on it, and, he's black and he's a reporter. He said, look, if you guys all cared, you should have cared when he was discriminating against minorities in housing, things that really affect us.
Yeah.
Just him talking in a private conversation to his girlfriend about society's feelings.
I think it's a great point. And by the way, none of this, not one bit of what we've talked about for as long as we've been talking, should ever lead anybody to the conclusion that, and I'll speak for both of us here, that either of us think that what he said was right or just or appropriate or any of that. It's not defensible in that sense at all.
I'm happy to see him gone. I ultimately I'm wrestling with the means to get to a result that I'm happy with.
Yeah, but I think the Supreme Court did it just recently in a search case involving anonymous tips, and it sort of cloaked itself as a DUI case where an anonymous tipster said that this guy ran him off the road, and there was really nothing else. and the police observed no illegality. They stopped the car. Then they smelled dope. This guy had 30 pounds in the bed of his truck. Mm-hmm. And basically in a 5-4 split, the majority says, yeah, good enough.
Right. To me, that's scarier. You know, the fact that the highest law in the land is being made up sort of by backing into it.
Yeah, I would back you up that's a whole other topic for another day.
Oh,
but results
sure.
oriented justice
yeah,
in the Supreme Court
for sure.
and how frightening that is. But I guess my point is that we see, I think results oriented justice is an issue that's been around for as long as there's been justice.
Yeah. Well, I'm just happy that you wrote the article because I just find that it's just hard to get a healthy debate going without articles like that. I mean, it's just once the avalanche is rolling in social media to try and say, hold on, when an avalanche is happening, it's gone. It's already too late.
Although it's interesting, I was on CNN. When was it? Day before yesterday. There was a poll of CNN viewers, and it appears that there's now some division where now as many as, I think it was approximately 40% of the people polled said, no, we've kind of backed off this idea about the for sale. So I wonder if cooler heads may be prevailing. Yeah, I thought that was fascinating. Although what was interesting to me is that more people who considered themselves to be basketball fans were in favor of forcing the sale. People that were not basketball fans were more open to the idea of not forcing the sale.
Right. I guess that makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, because there's an emotional sort of investment in having Sterling gone. If you're a basketball junkie, you know, there's definitely a strong sentiment of we got to get rid of this guy. I don't want to keep you too long. I'd like to let all of our listeners, this has been an amazing chat. I just want to make sure we have the moral correct. The moral is smoke weed, be bold,
dress well.
And when you're reading a book about sobriety, you should be lit up. Dress well.
I think you've been hearing me perfectly.
Yes,
you got it.
dress well and don't be afraid. That's really it. Be authentic and don't be afraid.
Yeah, you know what? I do a lot of keynote speaking, and that's the thing that really is that really drives me, is to be able to share my message powerfully as I can with audiences to help inspire and help people get the cuffs off. You know, it's funny. My website is nocuffs.com, and we haven't talked at all about marketing. We should talk about marketing in the legal space. That's definitely another hour-long conversation.
We're going to have you back on the podcast for all that
love
stuff.
Love to. But Matt, if I can quickly make the point, you know, that for me, No Cuffs has been my marketing brand for a long time, and I own the phone number 800-NO-CUFFS. But I've really, in recent years, begun to think of No Cuffs as more of a metaphor, that it's not just about the physical handcuffs that go on when people get arrested, but that No Cuffs really is about freedom. And it's about freedom to be free from addiction, to be free from self-limiting beliefs, to be free from negative self-talk, to be free from the failures and transgressions of the past. And so that to me, and that's where my public speaking is so personally valuable to me. You know, when you tell a joke to a TV camera in the studios, you never get to hear the laugh, and you never get to know the impact that you have. And every year, my law firm, for our holiday party, we go to a drug and alcohol treatment center in Pacoima, not the most affluent area. And it's a treatment center that caters to women who are either pregnant or who have kids, which is a very difficult population to get treatment for addiction. Most places won't take them. And so we, so my office holiday party is we take a, we prepare food, we bring it to this place, there's 80 women and their kids there, and we serve it to them, and we bring them a motivational message along with phone cards, because it's the freaking holiday time, and these women are indigent, and they can't even call people to tell them that they love them. And we bring them bath gels so they can feel pretty and feel feminine and feel good about themselves, even though they're in this place where they think it's the worst time in their life, and actually it is the touchstone to their life turning around. And to me, I mean, bring your own damn box of Kleenex when you come this year, and I invite you to come. It is the best thing that I do all year. And so my mission in my life is to connect with people on that level and make a bigger difference. This is probably the wrong marketing thing to say, but I'm probably the only criminal defense lawyer around who's actively trying to put himself out of business by helping a population of people make better decisions so they don't need criminal defense lawyers.
Yeah, well, that is a great message. And so no cuffs, I mean, what is it, nocuffs.com for that stuff? For
the, yeah, for, oh, if, call, if anyone, yes, and if anybody needs me, call, yeah, call me at 800-NO-CUFFS, or if you want me on Twitter, I'm just at Darren Cavanoki, common spelling. Good luck with that.
Yeah, and is there a website for all your other stuff, for all your media stuff they want to check
yeah,
out?
Yeah. But my media is at DarrenKavanoki.com. It's DarrenKavanoki. But I think all that's going to get migrated over.
Well, this was a really fun, one of the more fun chats we've had on the podcast. And I would definitely love to have you back on to talk, you know, more legal topics of the day anytime.
Absolutely. I would love to come back, and thanks for having me.
All right. Thanks, Darren.
That was a terrific interview, and now I want to hit up the Twitter feed and to give a shout-out to some of our new followers at Only in Law School, Yazan Siouf, Christina Bella Castro, Alan Duran, Sway. Let's see who else we have here. We've got the Mo Pezzi, Sarah Cole, Learn Leo, Kay, Natalie, Tucker Stewart, Vin D., Law School Made Easy has been helping us out with a bunch of retweets and favorites, and Harry Snape, Shay Lawrence, Alexandria Murphy, Z, Brandon Blake, Cody Vadrine. Let's see, who else, what other followers we have here? We've got Christy Pickens give us a shout out, Brittany Jones, Debbie S, Amanda Lynn, Julie, Amber, Ryan Monaco, Sarah May Levers, and Emily Hillard, and that 3L you know. So thank you guys for following us and tweeting at us. We really appreciate it. And once again, congrats on all of you finishing finals this week. And we'll talk to you guys next week on the next episode of the podcast.